All right, folks out there in listener land, otherwise known as Internetica, as I like to call it. This is Dave the Clone, the mastermind of the Hollow Nine, and I am actually giving an official introduction to this episode, which is actually part one of a two-parter, because as the collection of dust-covered recordings in the vault has run extremely low, a stroke of amazing luck happened to appear in, out of the ether. And as it so happens, as you're listening to this on September 8th, your 20 years and one day, so 20 plus one, 20 years and one day plus one there for the anniversary of HBO's Carnival. And it was September 7th, 2003 when that show first debuted. And as luck would have it, you know, anyone who's been listening for a while or just anybody who's known me in general in those last 20 years, you'll know that that was an extremely important show for me. It was definitely one that captivated my entire being and imagination, much like the same way that Twin Peaks had before that. And I've always considered its early cancellation to be somewhat tragic in the ways that some incredible shows are taken from us before they get the chance to really fulfill and you know, run their course. And as it would so happen to be, in 2017, I was lucky enough to be the personal assistant for Daniel Knopf, the creator of that show, at a small convention up in Long Island, formerly known as ICON. I don't think it's been going on for a while now. But yeah, it was kind of like getting to hang out with a hero for the weekend, and we just kind of palled around and talked about writing, talked about TV, and he shared an awful lot of anecdotes about working on The Blacklist and some of the projects he's worked on since Carnival. But really, you know, one of the reasons he's one of my idols is just because he was able to create such a mythology heavy world and able to get, even if it was just the first two seasons or book one of the overall structure of the story there. It was planned to be a trilogy of books or six full seasons on HBO. And for God's sake, if they would have just given those last four seasons, man, this thing would have been insane by the end of it. So as luck would have it, he and I happen to be friends on Facebook. And he was asking, hey, you know, for the 20th anniversary, if anybody's up for an interview or wants to just chat Carnival, I'm all about it. So I jumped on that wagon immediately, sent him a message, and you're about to hear part one of what I, you know, when you go into these things, you kind of just, I guess, as a industry standard, you figure, all right, we'll probably chat for an hour and maybe you'll wind up getting it cut down to like 40 minutes of the episode. I don't know. We'll see. We wound up chatting for almost two full hours. It was like an hour and 54 minutes, I think, when I stopped recording. So this will be part one, hour one. And just a quick note too, in the show notes, I have linked an article from the AV Club from in 2013, the 10-year anniversary interview that Dan did with them, where he talked a little bit about sort of where the show came from. And then there's a part two to that article about what the sort of high level of what the show's ending would have been like. And I'll link that in the show notes for part two. And that way you have some of the references for some of the things that we bring up and talk about. But in general, this was an absolute blast getting to sort of just dive deep. And we also go off the rails quite a bit too. So I think there's a lot to enjoy for everybody. So without further ado, we're babbling for me because I tend to do that when I'm introducing episodes where I speak to like a hero. This is part one of the Dave Maresca experience, as Dan calls it, with Daniel Knopf on the 20th anniversary of Carnival. Enjoy. But yeah, man, it's been what, since 2017 in Long Island at the LA Geek Con, the last time we got to hang out and talk about writing.
Yeah, probably. Carnival. Probably.
So it's almost like a multi-year reunion on a couple levels here. But thank you for throwing out just the option to do this, because I know I'm sure you probably are inundated constantly with messages wanting to talk about Carnival and what could have been and where it could have gone. And
yeah, but I'm not, but not, but not from Dave Maresca. So I mean, obviously, it's like
there, every once in a while, the universe will coalesce and give us the opportunity to do cool stuff. So thank you so much for giving me a chance. And I figure, you know, we could attack it from as high level or as low level as you like. I kind of feel like I'll just ask some kind of, I'll lob some softballs out there and then see where the...
Go ahead and ask questions and I'll try to... It's weird because often I get the same questions, so people get the same answers. And so it's like... probably not as interesting.
Right.
You know, it makes it more difficult for me to change it up.
Sure.
And I've talked so much about this show that it's like, oh no. But every once in a while, I'm counting on you for
something unique. Something a little different.
Yeah. You'd have to throw me these softballs.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, it's I think the big shock was when you threw it out there and you said it's been 20 years. And I've considered the cancellation of Carnival to be one of the great cinematic war crimes on TV in a long time. So but then to put it in the context of it's been two decades since the show has premiered. It really shocked me that much time has gone by, because I watch it so much. I watch it now that luckily Max still has it on. I feel like it's always been a little bit of a blessing that the network that canceled the show still has it on its streaming service.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because I think, you know, if they just stuck with it. For four more seasons, and to this day, I'm not exactly sure why it was canceled. I think there were corporate politics involved. I think there were aspects of just show politics involved. It was an expensive show. Their expectations for it were almost impossibly high. They were sort of riding this. You know, Chris Albrecht was getting the, you know, cover of, you know, big magazines and saying, oh, you know, HBO is just like the greatest thing since sliced bread. So I think the critics kind of had their knives out. And, you know, our reviews were not universally, you know, over the top. You know, we love it. We got some really kind of nasty reviews. I remember one from Us Magazine. And a couple of others where it was like, this makes no sense, or it's pretentious, or, you know, whatever. And it was like, I'd be just scratching my head going, the one from Us struck me because they actually started with the name of the show. Like, they, not even the name of the show. They were like upset that there was an accent. There was like an accent over the A, you know? Yeah. And I remember that specific reporter at the upfronts saying, what's with that accent over the A? And
it's hard to find on the
keyboard. I was kind of like, what a weird question to get, you know, you're sitting on stage, you get the, and I explained it. I said, well, I mean, it's ironic. This is this shit show, Dust Bowl, cheap ass, raggedy ass Carnival. And that they're trying to, you know, affect this sort of European elan. And I thought that was, you know, kind of funny and sad. You know, but apparently she didn't hear my answer because she always is so pretentious. I was like, well, yeah, they were being pretentious. That's the whole idea of, you know, that.
Yeah, but it was that kind of tongue-in-cheek gravitas, you know what I mean? Where, because even with the music, you know, when I rewatch the episodes, and I mean, for me, it's a total nostalgia bomb, not realizing it's 20 years have gone by. So, okay, every time I watch this, I feel like I'm 23 again, watching it for the first time. And you have that kind of like, there is something so mythical going on that, like, even the way that the music had that sort of like on the same level of John Williams' Star Wars, you know, it's letting you know that this is something big that you're just stepping into, and to not have some every aspect of the sort of overall big picture, you know, I thought the biggest thing for me is when I'm trying to write about it on Facebook and ask people, you know, because there's constantly in the groups I'm in, you know, what are some of the best shows that you know of that were canceled too soon? And you write Carnival and you're like, I'm just going to spell it with the E. And I don't even know what the keystroke is to get that accent.
I'm sorry, right? It was the E. It was not over the A. I got it.
Yeah, well, it was over the A and then there's an E at the end. So you're kind of like, wow, it's Carnival, right?
Well, I don't know. I don't know where the – I think the accent's over that first A or second A. I don't know.
Right now.
It's escaping me now. I think it's over the second A. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. I'll look at the menu once it comes up on Max. But, you know, one of the things, too, that I think probably not a lot of folks who watch the show, because not everybody would go, you know, detective dirt digging after the show got canceled to be like, well, I need any little piece I can to try to complete this in my mind. They left us hanging. And it's like heartbreaking because I would come into work and the water cooler about the show was off the charts, and especially after that second season finale, everyone's like, but the corn started dying, there's gonna be something amazing happening next season, and we're all like, yeah man, Justin's not dead, it was just like a miniature first confrontation. And then to be left going, you know, it's almost like when you read a book and then the author never writes the next book, and you're like left with like, well, we could imagine kind of some of the stuff that would
happen. it's even worse than that, because the book's, you know, it's like getting a third of the way through the book and then somebody just snatches it out of your hand and won't give it to you, you know?
Yeah.
I'm currently in talks with HBO and, there's the idea. I don't want to get everybody all excited, sure. But, you know, when you sell something to a network, they buy everything. They buy the underlying rights. They buy, you know, every medium, you know, uninvented and invented and throughout the known and unknown universe. And so, you know, you can't really do anything without, you know, saying, Mother, may I? But right. I'm looking into, I mean, Carnival, the two seasons of Carnival represent the first book in a trilogy. So the first book takes place in 34 and 35. The second book takes place in 39 and 40. And the third book takes place in 44 and 45. And so I've been looking into publishing those as novels. Great big.
Oh, wow.
Great big stinky novels.
Hopefully
we'll turn the corner with it. I think, you know, by the time I finish those and people look back at it, we flirted with going in. We went in and pitched it wasn't really what I wanted to pitch. But, I mean, I think the only way to really do it again would be to reboot it entirely with a new cast. Start with book one and go to book two and book three. To pick the story up, you know, at this point, everybody's, there's people who are just, they're too old, you know?
Yeah.
We went in and we pitched it and they passed, which was, I think, a good thing for, they wanted to, okay, let's pick it up where we left off. And I wasn't that eager to do that. So.
Well, I feel like, you know, we're in the time where another show that was famously kind of left dangling with Twin Peaks and then came back 25 years later and they brought all the original players back and, you know, sort of had a mixed effect. Like your first couple episodes, you're like, oh, this is awesome. It's back. And then as it's going on, you're like, all right, this is weird. I'm not really sure. Maybe it would have been better to kind of leave it as it was. But with Carnival, I remember, I think when we were hanging out in Long Island way back when, was still within the window of like, well, you know, there is a time jump right between books two and three, and then there would be another time jump between books four and five. So maybe there was some hope if they could
take it out of the troops. But 5 years, not 20. You know?
Yeah. At this point. Well, I mean, it started, and I guess for me, the idea too, I think, is that, you know, at the time, maybe the world wasn't ready for these sort of the scope of a show like this. You know, one of the things that always strikes me is how much of the world you could tell is there from the very beginning, and how we're going to be exploring all this. And maybe it was pre, you know, all this sort of high concept stuff that's happening or has happened since. Yet not a lot of them have had the ability to go beyond, you know, 2-3 seasons. Like, look at Westworld, where it was sort of, they just kept digging and building and layering more layers on top of their world. And after 3 seasons, people were like, yeah, we're kind of not following this anymore. So,
yeah, I think there's a sense of baking it up as you go along, and you really can't. That's not such a great idea. Yeah, in a way, I kind of like welcome the idea of articulating the rest of the story in a formal way. I know where it is in my head, but you know, you can only carry around so much in your head. So, when we did Carnival, it was the landscape, the television landscape, and yeah, people kind of forget this, doctors, cops, and lawyers. It was still network episodic drama. That was the overwhelming programming choice. There weren't many serials. And even the shows like The Sopranos, they had serial elements in it, but they were definitely episodic.
Mm.
So we were writing a pure serial, and I was incorporating novelistic approaches, like parallel narratives with, you know, people with characters that don't meet each other for the duration of like an entire season. And, you know, HBO was down for that. And so we were doing a lot of things that, you know, we've seen other shows do since. And the show was pretty much, it was, I would say about 95% consistent with my vision, you know, which is really, really good for a TV show.
Yeah.
You're working with hundreds of people, and each one has their point of view and, you know, their interpretation of what's coming across in a script. So, you know, I just remember sort of sitting there with my mouth open going, oh my God, I can't believe that this looks just like it did in my head, you know?
Yeah.
But there were things that I couldn't get in that were, I mean, there was one entire, there were big, big blocks of it that HBO said, no, won't do that. And it was very frustrating. But they'll be in the novels. So,
nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no show, but the novels are still a possibility then, because I mean, for me, I'm already like, I'm pre-ordering them right now. I'll pre-order them directly from you just so I can, I mean, I read when you sat down with the AV Club in 2013 and you kind of gave a high level of what you envisioned for the ending and even for a few bites about what, like where season 3 would have started. And it reminded me, I mean, like the fact that you started with so much foundation because of the pitch document, which was what I was beginning to allude to. I found that online, you know, as soon as season 2 ended and HBO crushed a whole bunch of us by letting us know that it wasn't going to be coming back. It was fine. I was at work, working in a corporate studio in Jersey City, and we had guests in, you know, to they were shooting a webcast, a live program that day. And over lunch, someone was like, oh man, you know, the Carnival season finale was so crazy. When's that coming back? And I had just read the announcement that it wasn't. And I'm like, well, let me ruin your day. It just got ruined about 5 minutes ago. And they were like, what? How could they leave it like that? And I feel like, you know, when I was digging for anything that would sort of give hints, and that pitch document, can you tell me a little bit about, because that felt like it must have been an entire project in itself just to kind of pull together this sort of detective's notebook about all these historical stories.
Funny thing that, I mean, my career is a very weird thing. My career trajectory is bizarre. And the first thing I had produced was a Western that was released by HBO called Blind Justice with Armando Sante. And that was back in 1990. And I remember driving out to the set, and I was really happy. So it was a Western, and I'm driving out to the set, and I thought, what if this is it? What if this is the only thing I get up? Oh, no, don't even think that. And then like nothing. it was like I sort of caromed off the stratosphere, and I had a couple of sort of, you know, a couple of projects that went into development after that, but nothing really happened. And so it was really a full decade later, you know, I like to call it, I was in the crest of a slump. And and I created this website. I posted the pages in the first act, and we took to HBO, and they said, you know, well, I get a call from Robert Kaobod, who works for Scott Winant, who's like an Emmy winning director or showrunner. And he says, okay, well, you need to put together a Bible. And I'm thinking, I don't know what a Bible is. I mean, I'd never done a series television. And he explained it to me. And so I went home and I started writing this thing, you know, character synopses and stories and et cetera, you know. And I just was, God, it was just drudgery. You know, it was boring. Yeah. And I thought, you know, if this is boring for me, you know, it's going to be boring for whoever reads it, you know.
Right.
I mean, the first line of defense against, you know, something shitty is me, you know. And if I'm finding it tedious, you know, that's a problem. And so I just decided, okay, I'm going to do this as if it really happened, as if the characters are all real. And I'm going to write it from the point of view of a college professor who's doing research into this sort of rumors and myths about this weird carnival that was traversing the Midwest in the, you know, between the world wars. And so I created fake religious tracts, fake police reports, fake newspaper articles. I had an interview with Samson when he's in the old folks home. He wants to do is catch a cigarette from the guy. And so I created this whole document. And it was funny because when we met with HBO, Carolyn Strauss and said, but you didn't tell us this really happened. It's like I was going, wow, bingo, I succeeded. And it's like, no, this is all fake. It's all fake. So, I mean, I was a big X-Files fan when it came on. And remember the first season, I felt like me and my son were like the only people watching it because nobody was really talking about it. And right. I was like totally into it. We're like, this is a great show. And right. About three episodes in, you suddenly begin to go, you lose faith in, you know, in the narrative. And you go, they really don't know what they're going to do here.
Right.
And once you've broken that trust with the audience, you know, it's, you can't get it back. That's really where it's very difficult to get back. And I mean, up until I did Carnival, I'd been a consumer, not a producer of, you know, film content. And so, it was very much in the frame of mind of the fan. It's like, no, I'm going to either write down or be knowledgeable about the 70% of the iceberg that's never going to be filmed. And there's always going to be a there, because you, even if you don't see it, you know it's there. You know, yeah. I think there's a gut instinct, at least in an astute viewer, where they know when you're faking it. Mm-hmm. They know when you're doing, you know, what was that thing about the crashed airplane?
Lost.
They know when you're doing Lost. They really are just throwing shit against the wall and seeing what sticks. And there's a consistency there, you know. It's like, you know, it's like a character that's not just doing things that are cool or doing things to be, to be convenient or, you know, convey some exposition. It's like everything is consistent. Everything feels rooted in something. And so that's what I really made an effort to do with Carnival.
Yeah. Yeah. No Monster of the Week episodes. You know what I mean? It was just all mythology all the time. And every time a new mythology like page was turned, there was like four more levels to go into. I mean, even with the way that the lingo worked, and the sort of the interconnectedness, I mean, bringing in the Knights Templar, you know, was such like a mind fuck for me when that happened. I was just like, well, wait a minute, now we're talking about like the Cup of Christ and stuff here. And I mean, it was all the way that the magic and the religion were handled,
and the real life occultists Aleister Crowley of it all.
Oh my god, you know? And I think that's another thing that maybe was such an early sort of dose of something like that. You know, you're like, it's interesting that we bring up X-Files because it has like, it wanted to have that same feeling. Like even if you watch that show, I've done rewatches on X-Files and I only watch the mythology episodes because I feel like those Monster of the Week ones water the whole thing down. And that was because, you know, that was network TV, was like 25 episode seasons back then. Whereas, you know, you have a nice tight 10, 12 episodes in an HBO show, everything's got to have that same punch, right? That same, like, we moved the story forward.
Yeah, you got to pack it pretty tight. And I would get people say, well, nothing happened. You know, and it's like, are you nuts? Were you watching? In season one and two, we'd get these complaints like, this show's boring, nothing happens. It's like, I don't know, man. We're working real hard to make sure shit's happening. Yeah, I know. I'm in the room.
It's crazy because I've introduced a few people to the show over the last decade or so, people who like missed it when, you know, it flew completely under their radar. And they'd be about halfway through the first season going, wait, so they canceled this. And I'm like, yeah, it's nuts. Just wait till we get to season two. Like, if you feel like it's moving now, it really like it drinks a bunch of 5-hour energy between seasons one and two. But every time I'm rewatching it, I don't feel like season one is slow. You know what I mean? And it's only once in season two, you're like, whoa, now we're on steroid. We're like, we're really trucking along.
Well, season two, Ron Moore was the showrunner and I was basically executive producing. And so there was, you know, there was not a unified vision. And so there was a lot of compromise going on between him and me, which I think slowed things down. But once he left for Battlestar Galactica, you know, I kind of had the reins of the story and I was able to give it a good flogging.
Yeah. Not that again, I will always come back to like season one, when you're watching it, if you're not just like, it's like so much wonderment is washing over you that, you know, I feel like there was no time to feel like it was boring. But at the same time, I think there are probably things I've gone through in my life that now when I watch the show, as much as I feel like I'm 23 again watching it for the first time, I go, you know what? Rita Sue was kind of a fucking psycho as far as a partner goes. You know what I mean? A romantic interest. Like when I first watched that show, I was like, I don't care what anybody says. That blonde chick is banging. I would be all over that. Just like, I'd be like, yep, we're doing this. But, you know, I recently went through a relationship with a malignant narcissist and on the first rewatch I did after that, when I was sort of in the last couple of years, I've been sort of in this weird, I mean, I guess I'm in the crest of my slump, you know, crest of my slump at this moment with being between projects, being sort of like trying to claw my way back from having my life demolished by this woman. And I'm watching it and I'm like, holy shit, I was with my own Rita Sue in real life. And it had this now reverse flash effect where I'm like, yeah, I'm not finding her attractive anymore. In fact, I'm like, Jesus Christ, Jonesy, get away from this chick. So it's
kind of... Oh, wait, you're talking... Yeah, Rita Sue. But all the characters, I mean, I love them all. So, Rita Sue's... Rita Sue is... Rita Sue was a really fun character. She had her moments. And, that's the main, you know, the main thing on this stuff is, I think, you know, as far as you know, writing stories, is connecting with your audience on that kind of a level is where it's like, okay, well, this person isn't just like this person who's in my life, but they're kind of like that. And maybe the way this character, I'm watching this other character making all sorts of boneheaded mistakes that are the same mistakes I'm making. So maybe I should do something different, or maybe I should do something kind of like what he's doing. you know?
Yeah. Or maybe realize that life should be like a TV show. It's okay for it to happen to people on TV where there are less consequences in reality.
Well, you're moved. You're moved by it, and it changes maybe the way you approach a situation or a relationship. Maybe I'm not appreciating this relationship enough. You know, maybe I'm taking this for granted. I mean, there's a lot of takeaways from a show that, you know, might not, you know, directly relate to your life in any way. But there's, we on TV, the relationship is with the characters. And, you know, it's not plot driven. It's about how well you connect up with the characters. And I mean, that's like, to me, that's like the great failure of The One Ring is there's nobody on that show for me. I can't connect with anybody on that show. And other shows where, you know, there's other shows where I'm like Breaking Bad. Well, you know, I was going to watch that show and I was prepared to hate it because I was seeing, you know, meth is devastating, you know, like hundreds of thousands of lives, and they're making, you know, this guy has to make meth and he's my hero.
Right.
But no, I connected up with it. I connected up with Walter White's desperation and his need to take care of his family and how that, you know, noble purpose becomes corrupted as time goes on. And what happens when you give, you know, a rabbit, you know, a gun, you know, it's like all of a sudden it's like I've been scared my whole life. I just finished watching Duel, which is a brilliant movie if you haven't seen it. Directed by young Spielberg, written by Richard Matheson at the peak of his freaking craft. And I watched it, and as I watched the end, you know, in the car, the big spoilers I had, you know, but when the evil truck, you know, crashes, and they got Dennis Weaver, and he's won, you know, and he's sitting on the edge of that, and this is the guy presented as sort of a meek, rabby kind of guy, and the only time we see is his outside. The only time they step outside the highway narrative is when he calls home to his wife and she scolds him for not, you know, hey, this guy was hitting on me. He's practically raping me and you didn't do anything, you know? Very economical setup for the character. And so here you've got this very meek character and he's forced to become, he's forced into action. And they've covered that theme. I mean, a lot of times that, you know, Dustin Hoffman movie, trying to think, Marathon Man. I mean, that's a very, And so I'm watching him at the end of the movie. I'm thinking, okay, what kind of a guy is Dennis Weaver going to be from here on out? And is this a good thing? You know, it's like maybe he's going to go home and slaughter his family. I mean, who knows, you know? But
yeah,
anyway, I've gone way off topic here. So rope me back in.
The road between here and Babylon is a twisty one, so it's fine if we stop off and witness some Mad Maxy before the apocalypse. You know what I mean? And that's too. You know, it's the same thing I think with people. Like, you know, it took me a long time to even get into sort of the Mad Max universe for the same reason. Like, do I want to watch what our world is going to be like when we have no reason to have our morality anymore? You know what I mean? And I resisted watching Breaking Bad for a while for the same reason that you did. Like, I'm like, I can't see myself rooting for a meth dealer. And at the same time, you know, the same thing that will happen usually with a show like this is I'll catch an episode that's deep in season three when I'm flipping around. You know, not that we do that anymore. Now everything is streaming. You don't have that phenomenon of flipping around and catching just a piece of something and going, wait a minute, what the hell was that? Now let me go back and watch the beginning.
Yeah.
I saw when he kills the two drug dealers who were going to kill Jesse Pinkman, that he was going after them because they were getting the kids involved. And I just caught like a 2 minutes where he ran those two guys over and then he turns to Jesse and goes, run. And I was like, I think I need to rethink this. I think I need to, you know, and it's funny because I remember when I first watched season one of Carnival, a friend of mine, we had a Sunday night HBO ritual, right? We would either get together at his house or my house, and we would watch not Sex and the City, but we'd watch Sopranos and we'd watch whatever shows were after. So it was like The Wire was in there for a while, but to us, the golden era was Sopranos, Carnival, Deadwood, and then, you know, whatever they would throw after Deadwood. But it was this sort of like, that was the best collection we had. And I had missed the first two episodes of Carnival. So we started with Tipton with the slow motion.
Those were good episodes.
Oh, trust me. Once I saw them, I was like, holy shit. You know what I mean? Like, thank God at that time, On Demand was brand new also. So I could go in and watch them when I was... When I realized what I'd missed. But, you know, that first first minutes of Tipton where it's, you know, the slow motion and the first it's one guy standing there by himself and then the procession of people bringing out a small coffin and putting it on a carriage and the two worlds of the carnival coming into town and these people like at the end of their rope, like kind of crossing paths and you're just like, what is this? What's going on here? And you're just instantly drawn in by that banjo, you know, the music, again, with the music. The music for this show really helped build the sort of serious.
Yeah, well, just to give you some inside dope on that whole thing is I think in the script, it's like there's a funeral going on and a carnival arrives in town. I mean, I don't think there was much to what was on the page. And I got a call in my office from our editor, and unfortunately, I don't remember his name. And he said, I put a little something together for the beginning. I wonder if you like it. And he showed me that sequence. And it was just, it was like, whoa, you know, yeah. I mean, this is amazing. And, sure. And which to me is, you know, illustrative of everybody on the show was bringing their best game. Everybody on the show seemed to be aware of the fact that this playground I'd created was a playground where they would all get their turns and they would be able to play their solos and they'd be able to really knock it out of the park. And then all this shit was going to end up in the reel someday, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, that was the vibe on set. That was, you know, when a new script would be published, I would always walk around the lot just to see people sitting in their trucks and reading, and they didn't have the highlighters out. They weren't there marking the shit they had to do. They were actually engrossed And so everybody felt like they're part of something special, the cast, the crew, every single person involved on the show. But I've been on shows since, and it's not that way, you know, unfortunately.
Yeah. The magic of what you had going on in your head sort of immediately manifested itself in the reality of putting it together.
Well, it was so different. It was just, you know, it's like, what are we going to be doing this week? Holy shit.
Yeah.
The bearded lady's going down on the, or the blind guy's going down on the bearded lady. You know?
And the whole carnival is just, it's like still working outside. They're like, oh geez, they're, it's their weekly, you know, it's their every other day, whatever.
And the way the show was shot too, and this was Scott Winant who brought this to the party, is we treated the camera. I think really Rodrigo Garcia kind of set this in motion with the pilot, but one thing that throws you out of period dramas, okay, and I think this was a failure on the part of Deadwood, all the swearing broke the fourth wall. Now, you know, they would go on about, you know, oh yeah, they used to swear, it was documented that in Deadwood people swore like sailors and blah blah blah, but then again, swearing back then was probably a very different thing. Like if you said damn in front of a woman, people would be like, oh, you know,
pearls and fainting. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, in context, I doubt they were dropping motherfucker, you know, and that would kind of take. So in Carnival, that's why you don't hear a lot of swearing. I mean, I think we dropped the F-bomb maybe three times in the course of two seasons. And likewise, just visually, we treated the camera, although the camera was, you know, a modern piece of technology, very light, you know, and we were shooting film. We weren't shooting digitally. But even nice. Still, those cameras, we treated them like they weighed 500 pounds apiece, which is what cameras weighed in the 30s. And our only frame of reference for the 30s is movies we've seen set in the 30s or that were made in the 30s, right?
Yeah.
And nobody's swearing. Okay, so that's going to throw the audience out. So that's why, you know, I didn't want to have people swear, even though I'm sure people in carnivals were just, you know, foul mouth, but I didn't want it to bump people out. And the camera, if we'd been flying the camera around, and we did a little bit of flying, but we'd work into it. We'd always kind of work into it. And it would usually be involved in a fantasy sequence or a piece of magic happening. But, you know, the way we would work with the camera, a lot of times we just had it on sticks. And we're moving it very slowly with a dolly. And, you know, we were treating camera as if it was this massive piece of equipment. And that connected up with the story. So.
Yeah. Oh, man. I mean, it's
really, this is geeky inside shit. So
no, fuck it though, because that's all of that is what coalesces to make it different. I mean, like, you know, one of the big things about what HBO claimed, I'm sure it's not that it's not true, that it was expensive because of like location shooting and because of building Colossus, because of having to have these sort of vast areas, where I think now they would just probably put up those LCD screens behind it and build one little piece and have one tent. And then, you know, they could kind of shoot it from different angles and just change the background around. And that would be, okay, we've taken care of some of the budget.
Well, that was one of the things I had a problem with from the beginning. First of all, I just want to correct you. We did not build Colossus. I bought Colossus when we shot the pilot. I remember being given like, okay, we can, this Ferris wheel's $25,000 and this one's, I remember paying $28,000 for Colossus. It's like, oh, I never thought I'd get to buy a Ferris wheel in my life.
Yeah.
Cool. can I take it with me when I, you know, when the show goes off the air, set it up in my backyard? But, you know, we would do company moves almost every episode of the first season. And I was sitting there, I'm going, guys, this is so stupid. I mean, do you remember that show Wagon Train? And all they would do is they'd have a, well, I don't remember it. I mean, that's how old it is. But, you know, there were shows like Wagon Train and they have a cry on at the bottom would say, you know, outside, you know, St. Pete or something, you know, whatever it would say.
Right.
Do you really think they were moving the wagon train anywhere? It was just sitting on a back lot and they'd bring in a couple of trees or something, or they'd move shit around. And that's all we needed to do. All we needed to do is sell the location with a cry on us. Here's where we are now. Nobody's we don't need to move every week. And so the second season we started doing that and saved a little bit of money. But I think the show was like 3.85 million in 2020, which is probably, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $7 million today, maybe. And there's a lot of shows that cost more than $7 million on the air. But the weird thing about it, it wasn't all going to cast. I mean, usually an expensive show, there's usually a star on it, and you got to pay him a lot of money or her. Mm-hmm. In this, it was really going toward the production.
Yeah. And it showed, and I think that's maybe that's part of what made it feel so immersive, you know. But at the same time, you know, to hear that it was so expensive and then it goes away and then like Rome comes on the following season, which I almost didn't watch out of protest. I'm like, look at this fucking thing. They got horses. They got all kinds of shit. You're telling me Carnival was too expensive. You went two seasons in. You left us wanting more. You left us dying for more. And then you bring in Rome and you only did two seasons of Rome. You know, maybe this is – it was sort of one of those things where I felt like HBO was starting to not falter completely, but they were sort of like, we'll take risks, but then if you don't, it was the beginning of this, if you don't jump on it in season one or season two, and we don't see that this is going to be like the way that Sopranos was just pulling people in forever, we're pulling the plug. We don't give a shit what happens. Like John from Cincinnati, you know, that one, I felt like it was a nice, almost like a mixing of the two worlds of David Milch and you know what I mean? Like that kind of like magical, but they were dropping F-bombs every other line in the dialogue. Whereas the dialogue for yours, it felt like you were watching a novel, which I guess is it ties to well to the idea that you have this as book forms. But like, I mean, like Samson, I was just watching the first couple episodes getting ready for our chat today. And in Tipton, I'm going to keep coming back to episode 3, right? Where he's like, yeah, I said, we can't set up. And he goes, what do you mean we can't set up? What am I speaking Swahili? And I was like, oh my God, dude, you feel this. You feel that like that's their version of telling you to go fuck yourself. You know,
I loved writing for Michael. He was, it was really funny. Another one was we did the pilot. I got the call. One of the producers came in. They said, HBO loves what they're seeing, but they're not loving Michael.
And
I said, well, I'll talk to him, you know?
Yeah.
And we went out to dinner, and I said, okay, tell me about Samson. I want to get your take on the character. And, you know, we talked a lot, but in essence, it was like, okay, well, here's the deal. Samson, he's like my dad. So he's like my dad. He says he's really hard on the outside, but once you get past that, he's just wishy. It's just a sweetheart. And I said, Michael, you're blowing the horn really well, but you're blowing it from the wrong direction, pal. Samson comes off like the sweetest guy in the world, but you cut the surface and it's tempered steel. And I saw, it was like one of those moments with an actor where just saw the light bulb go on in his head. It's like, oh, now everything makes sense.
Oh, shit.
And he came in and just started knocking it out of the park, and there was never any more talk about replacing Michael on the show. So, I really was kind of writing my dad when I wrote. I mean, he had a lot of lines, dig the stupid out of your ears. I mean, stuff like that. Yeah. My dad used to say.
We don't speak much of the Deutsch anymore, but
yeah. Yeah, for crying out loud. Yeah. You say stuff. You know, what was it? Yeah, you know, you want some grub? You don't sell food grub.
Yeah. Let me know what they're paying for breaking rocks up in Sing Sing or whatever. Johnny Law's coming to get your ass. I mean, there was so much about it, you know, and I feel like it's the kind of thing that when I watch the two seasons, I'm always hoping that I'm like, maybe at the end, something a little bit different will happen this time. And I can feel more at peace with the fact that this is all we're going to see.
Sorry. But maybe we'll get some novels.
I'm really, you know, whatever, if there's anything that the folks out in the in fan land can do to help that happen, I don't know if that's supposed to be.
No, I don't think anything. I just want to, and I can't say that it's a done deal, and I can't say, but it looks like it's proceeding along very nicely. We just need to wrinkle out some, you know, to deal with points and that kind of stuff. I hope to be diving into that soon. And I've been writing novels, believe it or not.
Wow.
Well, I've been writing books. I have a book called Stupid Writer Tricks on Amazon, which goes into my whole process and everything else. So nice. you budding screenwriters out there, you know, buy my book. unlike most screenwriting books, it's written by somebody who actually has done. I've got this other project called Gingerland, which I've got on my Substack, which is a Christmas story. So if you're, it's in the neighborhood of like Roald Dahl. It's a story meant to be, it could be read to kids, but it's really I think an adult story disguised as a kid's story.
Nice.
So, I mean, if you're curious as to like what the guy who wrote Carnival would do if he wrote like a Christmas fantasy story.
Yeah.
That's something you probably want to check out.
It's not like a Violent Night, right? Where it's basically just like, let's have Santa be a psycho.
This shit like that's so easy. I mean, it's not even, to me, that's just not even a challenge.
Yeah.
to take something and actually try to do something fresh and original with Christmas that has a heart is like really hard. I mean,
yeah.
Without getting treacly or, you know.
And you feel like because this product, I mean, there's so many questions I still have about what the beginning of the process
was. Go on. Hit me. Machine gun me.
Like even just bringing something like this to a writer's room with people who have already been writing TV and being the new guy on the block, you know what I mean? It's like, I know that 20 years later, you've got a lot more accolades under your belt, you know, the whole time you were on the blacklist and having written for Supernatural. But when you come in with something like Carnival and you're like the new guy in town, how do you get to that equal footing with them? How did you wind up getting to the point where you could not only compromise, but really sell the idea of what you were doing so that they would sort of not only buy in, but buy in and make it so that it was becoming what you had seen in your mind as it was being realized?
Well, I mean, I was hanging on by my fingernails a lot. I didn't know what was out of line. I didn't know what was appropriate. Television is a highly political endeavor. Okay. And I didn't understand the kabuki theater of it. And I would get chided for, oh, you shouldn't have put that person's name in the memo after that person's memo name. It would be like really stupid stuff. And I think there were people, I think, that had, I won't name names, but there were people who it benefited them to keep me off balance. A little bit, because I was a little bit like that little boy in the Twilight Zone who could wish people out into the cornfield. You know? they had this huge investment, and I was pretty much the only one who knew how to write the show. And
right.
So, you know, there was a lot of that. I think, you know, at first I came in and it was like, okay, guys, I'm really looking forward to learning from you, because these were all very seasoned writers. I mean, everyone who was on my staff had run a show. And we had a showrunner who at first, when we set out, you know, seized the reins and did so aggressively. And HBO is coming to him and saying, no, don't do this. We want this. And then as soon as the door closed, he'd be going, yeah, those people are full of shit. We're going to do this. And and what he wanted to do was bad. I mean, it was just like, it just fell into this cauldron of cheese, of whimsical crap, sort of pseudo Fellini-esque shit that he had in mind. And he was kind of faking it anyway.
Yeah.
And I realized this show, they're not going to green light my show if this keeps up, because he's not doing what they want. What they want is, we did the pilot. We want more of the pilot. Okay. And this guy's trying to redefine the show. And I realized at a certain point that I had to sort of take, the rewrite of the pilot, the first episode. And I just did a full page one rewrite on them.
Oh, wow.
And I remember calling HBO and saying, okay, you're going to get these stories in, and I hope you like them, from the showrunner they'd chosen. I hope you like them. He's dead now. So it was Henry Purnell, you know, and he had been given the showrunner slot. And I hope you like them, but if you don't make any decisions until you see my version, please. And so they looked at his, and they were on Monday morning, they pulled the plug on the show. They weren't going to go forward with it. And then Monday afternoon, they got my versions. So then Tuesday morning, the plug was back in, and Henry had been, you know, broomed off the show. So I had to learn how to be very ruthless to protect the vision and not just protect the vision. That's bullshit. To deliver what HBO wanted, you know, right. I mean, it's like I had made this promise to them. this is what the show is. And you don't welch on that with a network. They're on your side. And, you know, everybody's on your side at the end of the day. You know, yeah, you can't take that us versus them kind of bullshit. Now, I indulged in that my first year because I was green. And sometimes I felt like the whole world was against me when it really was not. But there were a few people rooting against me, you know, and I just had to, it was a white knuckler. The both seasons were very, very difficult for me. It didn't help that like Scott Winant, who I developed it with, who was my 900-pound gorilla, got broomed before we even did the pilot. So I had nobody I could go to and be my guru and say, okay, what do I do now? You know, I had to find my own way and it was tough, you know, but I survived it.
Yeah, man. Well, and you know,
what doesn't kill us, as they say. Yeah.
Now, is that a very common thing though, that there is usually sort of like a, an Obi-Wan to your Luke when you start out in this world of TV, or is it?
I've been on shows where you've got a green showrunner and they'll have a sort of a seasoned guy either on staff or he's an executive producer, who they can kind of like lean on and who will correct them when, I mean, I was in a room one time and we did a whiteboard. And the showrunner walked in and he says he had an Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
And so the Obi-Wan was involved in breaking the story and we broke the whole story and he walks in and he was a bit of a tyro, you know, and it's like, I don't see character anywhere here. I don't see character anywhere on this board. It's just plot, 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 plot. And I said, you don't do character on whiteboards. You do it when you write. And I hear from behind me, Obi-Wan go, here, here. And then I saw the attitude change of the showrunner up front. I go,
okay.
sometimes those guys are valuable, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Now, when you say that this was the show that HBO wanted, they wanted...
And by the way, that's the way things kind of were. Unfortunately, I don't think that it's been that way for probably 5 years now. I used to scratch my head and say, why are they giving the keys to the kingdom to these guys with like really unimpressive credits? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like very little experience. And even people who just, they've got a short they made at film school. Now they got a $5 million a week, you know, pattern budget on a show. Yeah. And I used to wonder what's up with that. And what I realized is, they want to get people who won't talk back to them.
Is that okay? Gotcha.
I think that's what it's all about.
And I feel like, you know, for us on the audience side of the fence, we can see the difference. You know what I mean? For what it's worth, not that I've watched it, but just when I saw the promotional stuff for that Amazon Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power, I was sort of like, the hell is this? And then you read about who's behind it and you're like, who the fuck are these guys? You know, and who am I? You know,
but I mean, that's a reasonable question. You're looking at it and you're going, how do these guys warrant $20 million an episode or some crazy shit? And I'm just thinking, I could have hit that right out of the park. I know like maybe two or three other guys that could have done that. But they didn't really have a shot at it. I don't know what that's all about.
Yeah, and it's sort of like when you think about the money being thrown around and that then Carnival was too expensive at the time. You know what I mean? You're kind of like, well, shit, we've come a long way from caring about that, I guess, in this world. I'm sure there's lots of other strange things that have happened in the world of entertainment, you know, not to get...
Streaming has created an immense amount of chaos and it's distorted the system. And then just certain, societal things have distorted the way things are done. And
And you have a very vocal community of folks, I guess, sort of like me, who do a lot more prolific on things like YouTube, where they will they'll critique you from the first minute they hear something they don't like. And it becomes a, oh, and can you believe they're gender swapping this for no reason, and they're race swapping that for no reason, and they're not being beholden to the source material, so we're done. We're not even going to give it a chance. And, you know, I'll fully admit that there are times where I've listened to that going, oh, well, if that's the case, I mean, you guys have done the research. I am still trying to figure out my life at times. So I just kind of see a trailer. And if the trailer doesn't compel me, I go, well, what the hell? I mean, a prequel Lord of the Rings series should be fucking awesome. What's going on here? And then you go, oh, there's sort of the agenda being snuck in there on things. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
And so why is there even an agenda? Why can't we just make shows anymore? You know what I mean? So,
yeah. I mean, but at the same time, you have this vast sucking hole of,
yeah.
Of, you know, like I was arguing with a friend, and I was saying, you know, I was saying, look, I think what really people want to see right now would be a show with a guy who's a completely unapologetic, swaggering kind of like macho guy hero, you know, like Magnum PI or something.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think people are kind of jonesing for that. And by that, I mean, men and women are kind of jonesing for that. And yeah. Because, you know, every time they do that, you know, every time, and it's very rare that they do, every time they do that, everybody, you know, people watch it, you know?
Yeah.
Having like female action stars, which, you know, I think there was a movie a long time ago with Gina Davis, you know, back in the early 90s when they did it, it was like, oh, this is so cool. This is so fresh. This is new. Yeah. A Long Kiss Goodnight was just like, what a great movie. I don't know. It didn't do that well, but I loved it. And it was so unique, but it's like, oh yeah, really? I'm gonna watch this woman who's 5'5" and weighs 102, dripping wet, kick the asses of a bunch of like mixed martial arts looking gorillas now.
Yeah.
And it's like, please, I've seen it, and it's fake. It's really, and in a way, I think it's actually kind of toxic. I mean, you see those YouTube videos where, you know, you see these women getting in these big guys' faces and screaming at them. And, you know, it's like, go ahead, hit me. I can take you. And it's like, no, you can't. I couldn't take him, you know?
Yeah, he can take you to court.
I just think that, you know, look, I'm all for I've seen some that work, but most that don't work. Some work beautifully, but most, it's so expected now.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And it doesn't speak to, I think, in a way, it doesn't really speak to the situation for most women, you know?
Right.
But it's
right.
Like, who are you speaking to with this? I don't know.
There needs to be more nuance to it than this sort of self-righteous indignation that I feel like is sort of cropping up, where it's like, well, I think you're kind of fixing something that's not broken. You know what I mean? It's not like we haven't had role models of all kinds or people who've stepped into the light, right? You know, no one argues about Ellen Ripley being such a badass or Sarah Connor, you know? So it's sort of like you have to, it can't just be that. It has to serve the story. I mean, you know.
Yeah, but Sarah Connor gets the shit kicked out of her. You know what I mean? And I mean, a lot of these things are just women. It's like they're taking full hits to the face, closed fists to the face, that would put down like a man, you know, and they're, you know, recovering back from that. And they're, you know, come on, please, you know.
I mean, maybe in the Marvel world, right, or the superhero world, which is now, I think, run a bit of a beyond fatiguing course.
stick a fork in that corpse. Yeah.
I mean, there was a moment where you're like, okay, we should celebrate this. Look, like these are things that have only been able to be done as cartoons before. They're doing a pretty cool job of them now. But, you know, the nuance and the sort of, you know, I guess from a generation that was raised on those type of movies, you could understand someone finding something like season one of Carnival being slow, where it's like, yeah, but look at what it's making. Look at what's being baked here. You know,
well, those are basically their fireworks displays. It's like they're not really movies; they're pageants, and it's a series of very special effects heavy action sequences that are being that are connected by the thinnest of narrative threads. Which is why when you walk out, you're always talking about, oh, remember the part when blah happened? Remember the part when, oh, that was awesome when blah happened. But if you said, well, what was the movie about? Some about guy wants to control the weather or something.
Yeah.
And there you have it, folks. That's the, we're going to cut it off right there and save the rest for next week. But, as you know, I think I gave a pretty accurate description when we opened up here about how it was going to sort of be a deep dive and then off the rails a little bit. And we covered an awful lot of ground. So I hope you enjoyed this. Go check out that AV Club article and come back next week for part two of the Dave Maresca Experience with Daniel Knopf for the 20th anniversary of HBO's Carnival. Adios.
You've been listening to the Hollow Nine Network, bringing you the very best in fan-made media. That's the word hollow, the number 9, INE. Find the Hollow Nine Network on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. Rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts. Email us at hollow9podcast@gmail.com. Leave us your feedback. Join in the conversation and be a part of the action. Join in the fun. Hollow Nine.